Alan Quinn Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 2, delivered on January 25, 2017. The title of this lecture is Special Topics.
Today, Special Topics. The first special topic that I'm going to go through with you is the topic of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a central bank. It is the central bank of the United States of America. All modern countries have a central bank, a bank that is essentially a coordinating entity for banking activities in the country. I'll go into the duties of the Fed here in a minute or two, in a while, and I've got, I don't know if I have it up yet, in ReggieNet in the Resources tab, there's a link to a video that explains the Federal Reserve. It was produced by the St. Louis Fed, which is sort of like the education Federal Reserve, the one in St. Louis. It's a cheesy cartoon video, but it actually does a pretty decent job of covering the basics of the Federal Reserve. I'll go into more detail, and I'll explain a little more to you over the next few over the next hour or so. And then I've got another topic I want to cover today, too. So the first thing to do is to talk about the Fed. But in order to talk about the Federal Reserve, I have to get back to some really, really basic ideas. The first basic idea to cover with you, and by the way, this is a lecture, which means that this is fair game. Oh, I forgot. I'm going to give you a surprise quiz on Monday in class, okay? So please be surprised. Okay? Oh my God, it's a quiz! Okay, that means you bring a smartphone or a notebook or a tablet and you actually will take it online through Learning Catalytics. And the first one is always rough when we do that, but we get through it and then you get used to it. It's actually a very good way to do this. And it's fairly straightforward. It's not a hugely difficult quiz. And also there's an online quiz, special topics quiz, that will be available for you to take as well. But the first thing I need to do before I go into the Federal Reserve is I want to ask you or talk to you and ask you a question about money. Okay, madam, what is money? You're on the right track. There's part of it, buy. That's one thing. Oh, let me talk. There are different kinds of money. Go ahead. What is money? It's a means of exchange. Well, it's a medium of exchange. Yeah, you got that from an economics class, it sounds like. And I am a financial economist, but it's economists can sometimes be a little bit strange, Rain Man kind of people. So we want to put it down into more permanent, more realistic terms. So you're going to be a part of this. You make incredible apple pies. Me, I hunt moose. So I am really in the mood for pie. No. And I've got a moose. So I come to your door, bam, bam, bam. And you say, who's there? And I say, it's the Prince of Darkness. Oh, hi, Professor C. And you open the door, and there's a big moose on my shoulders. Well, you found a girlfriend, Professor C. Knock it off. I want pie. I'll trade you moose for pie. Okay. So I get a pie, you get a moose. Boom. Okay. Now, you actually get everything you need by trading pies. There is a fellow who comes around, he sells eggs, milk, friendship, along the way. That's the only way you can get a friend, dude. No. What the hell is it? There's a pink flamingo on your hat.
I was looking at that.
Dear
too.
God, yeah, what is this? You know, wear your head backwards, you know. It's not fashionable, but the snipers still wear their hats that way. Now, that's really creepy because now you look like a sniper. Okay, anyway. Okay, the thing, though, is that you see those pies are actually money. Money is anything that is widely accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is widely accepted in exchange. Okay, so in other words, the reason these pies are money is not because someone declares it money, but because it's just accepted as money. Now, this is a kind of money called barter money. Barter money. Now, the thing about barter money, God, this is annoying. The thing about barter money, no, seriously, don't put advertisements on my board. The thing about barter money is that it has full intrinsic value. You could trade that pie for a moose, or you could eat that pie. It is fully, fully intrinsically valuable. Okay, and that's important because there are other kinds of money that meet the definition of money, they're widely accepted in exchange, that don't have that quality. In fact, barter money is the most common kind of money historically. And even to this day, it's very, very popular. Now, the idea that there was money all through history is the kind with coins and dollars, that's actually false. The truth of the matter is that the common people throughout history have, many people never had one coin or one paper piece of currency. Throughout history, that was something that, in your time, this is very unusual. A great example, interestingly enough, from ancient Egypt. The Egyptians were incredible chroniclers. Everything that happened to them, they wrote down in journals. Their scribes did. Their wars, their wins, their losses, their quirks, their who they liked, who they hated. And that's something that we most people don't know, is that if you want a good record of what was going on in ancient times, the Egyptians wrote everything down that was going on around them, if they knew about it. But another thing is that people think about the building of the pyramids as these masses of thousands and hundreds of thousands of slaves and whack. No, those were actually done by professional teams. They were like the sports teams of their time. In fact, we'll find inside of pyramids in the corridors, when a corridor was completed, the team that did it would leave their logo. We did this, this team, whatever the team, they gave themselves names of animals and things like that, and they were very proud of their work. And they lived in villages around the construction sites. And they were considered they were incredible athletes. Even when they lost limbs, they kept working, they kept contributing to their teams. But they were not paid money. They were paid in booze, food, and companionship. Now, another thing that is not well understood, this idea of the great worship of the pharaohs, no, most of them were really hated by about everybody. The pyramid of Cheops, the great Cheops pyramid, everyone hated Cheops. He was blowing money on this ridiculous, insane, multi-decade project, and the economy was falling apart. It was ridiculous. And everyone hated the son of a bitch, pretty much. And so he was trying to screw over his workers, these scribes, these athletic types that were moving these giant blocks, and the mathematicians who were figuring out how to put this thing together so it would stand the test of time, and the architects and the designers that would make it beautiful. What we see today is nothing like what they were at the time. They were actually covered in a white, almost like a porcelain, and you could see them for hundreds of miles. But he wanted to screw them over. He wasn't paying them, giving them food and booze and companionship the way they wanted. And so they actually went on strike. They struck for better living standards. And the scribes of the time, they just wrote it all down. This is really cool. A strike. In ancient Egypt, a strike against the pharaoh. Well, the pharaoh's inner circle of advisors said, well, we got to stop this. We just got to kill him. You know, put them to death. Make examples of them. Or at least some of them. Make examples of some of them. And then a couple of very wise old advisors said, that might not be such a good idea because, you know, if you execute those guys and those scribes, well, when they put up those hieroglyphs that tell where to go in the afterlife, they're probably going to send you to a sewer on the other side of Samaria. You dumbass, don't do that. That's not a good idea for the people who are going to determine whether or not you make it to a good place in the afterlife, or whether you even make it a few years after the pyramid is built, if they decide they want to make a few bricks that'll slip and fall down. Well, as it turned out, Pharaoh blinked and conceded to this demand for better living conditions, better wages. But they weren't wages in the sense of money. And that's the point I'm trying to get at. The idea, the concept of coin money and all that, that's actually not that common in history, especially for the normal people. Even for the better people, it wasn't. So now we come to the next kind of money, a kind of money that has some intrinsic value, but it's widely accepted. We're talking about metal monies. Sometimes they're called commodity monies. I don't want you to confuse a commodity like a grain, but you can call them metal or commodity money. Now, it's like I can use gold for a coin, but I can also use gold in certain types of designing. Gold isn't all that great. It's pretty as hell, but as far as it's kind of malleable and soft, it was considered throughout history in a lot of different cultures. One of its important uses, other than for making pretty things, was that it was considered a medicine, and it was ground up and people would eat it, or things like that. But as far, it had some intrinsic value. In other words, it had value in and of itself, other than as a thing that you could use for exchange. But it was still money because it was widely accepted in exchange. Gold, silver, there were other monies too throughout history that had their popularity, obviously platinum, but copper and other ones like that. So that's metal money. And now comes the last, but actually it's not the last kind of money. I'm teaching you guys in the last couple of years something that has never happened before. This used to be, I'd say, this is the last kind of money. This is money that is money. It is accepted in exchange only because it is required by law that you accept it. This has no intrinsic value. Okay, maybe for a piece of toilet paper or something like that. But realistically, this has no value in and of itself. It's like a gold coin or a moose or a pie. This doesn't have any value. The only reason we accept it is because we are ordered to. This is money by decree of a sovereign. Money by decree of a sovereign is called fiat money. It's actually pronounced fiat, but I've been criticized by people who don't know linguistics like I do. It's pronounced fiat. Well, whatever, okay, call it fiat. But it is actually pronounced fiat. But this money is money only because we require, the government requires us to accept it in exchange. It's widely accepted, not because it is wonderful, but because we have to. If we don't, we could be prosecuted. So these are the three classic types. And I've been teaching for 35 years, and I've always stopped until the last year or two. I always stopped here. But now I have to mention the fourth kind that exists. The first attempts at this, creations of this, were in the early 1990s with Microsoft Wallet or Apple Wallet. And then it kind of faded out, and now it's come back. Finance club students, I have exposed them to the world of this money, to the hashers and all of that. It's really hard to get your mind around it. You can think about it in theory, but most people who think about it in terms of fiat money, and it is not fiat money at all. It is completely different. It is called cryptocurrency. Does anyone know an example of cryptocurrency? Yeah? Bitcoin, but that's not the only one. But the hashers, they love themselves Bitcoin. And I just don't have the time or the resources. But cryptocurrencies, governments of the world are trying to control them, trying to declare this belongs to us. And they are prosecuting, but this is dark web. I mean, you don't play in this world unless you understand this world and you understand that walking off the path in the dark web is an invitation to a lot of going a little ways off the path of the cryptos in the dark web is a guarantee that your life will be changed by what you see in that world. But I won't get into that in too much detail. And if you want to know about it, you're on your own, sucker. But this is the world of Silk Road and snuff films and Lolita City and all that horror, the horror of that stuff. This is the dark world. But it's the world of the cryptocurrencies. These are currencies that they don't exist physically. There is no physical existence. No presence of them. They are represented by encrypted codes that uniquely identify a coin or an instance, as I might call it, an instance in the cryptocurrency world. They are being gathered by governments and by private interests around the world. The Chinese put hundreds of thousands, from what I hear, of their political and other prisoners to work in the world of cryptocurrencies, gaming or doing other things their entire miserable lives to gather these crypto coins for their masters in the Communist Chinese Politburo. In our country, there is a reserve of them in most big investment banking houses. The United States Treasury has trumped up charges of all kinds against crypto players to steal their money, to take their coins, to gather for themselves because they're too lazy to go out there and do it themselves. So they lie about people and take their crypto coins away from them. Same is happening in Europe. Russia is something of a player as well. Doing pretty much what China does. North Korea is also a player, a heavy player, using slave labor to gather crypto coins, and literally in some cases using entire electric generating plants to run the computers to do the hash, to run the hashes on these. So, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, I will be bringing back in my hash friends, hasher friends, and for an evening of explaining to you what this world is about if you're interested. So let me know if you are, because otherwise I don't want to waste their time when they could be sitting in front of their computers counting their stupid coins. Okay, but anyway, it's very cool though. you're in a generation, there's been nothing, this is not like anything before it in human history. This is something completely different. And don't try to correlate it with these. It doesn't. It is not like these. Now I want to bring up a term for you, and I might have brought it up already, but I have to really tighten it up now. The term liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Do you see this? This is highly liquid. See? Bloop, 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 bloop. Okay, that was... I have got to get a new joke writer. Okay, liquidity, some people say, well, liquidity is the ease with which you can turn something into cash. Well, that's not a very good definition, because cash is has a liquidity. Cash is the highest liquidity instrument you can get. Notice something about these types of money. The liquidity goes up as you move toward the more modern forms. Barter money is, I mean... You know, what if you don't want moose? What if I don't want pie? I mean, there's not that liquidity like there is. Metal money, I mean, you can convert it more quickly. However, I would guarantee you that you go to one of those fast food drive-thrus like Snarf and Barf or Inhale and Flail and all that, and you say, I would like a McCheeseburger, McPlease. And they say, why, Mick, yes, that will be Mick $18 and Mick 14 cents. Please pull through to the Mick drive-thru window. And you pull out a gold coin. Mick here. And they say, Mick what? Okay, you understand, though, the problem, that gold is great, but you try to buy a burger with it? You try to, it just doesn't work. So, in other words, even though... it is great, it is not highly liquid. Fiat monies are extremely liquid. There's only one thing almost as liquid as fiat money, that is U.S. Treasury bills. They're immediately tradable anywhere in the world, and they're considered banks, and this will be important for a little bit later, banks are considered, you're counting how much liquidity they have, they will count the... Treasury bills and the money as Tier 1 capital. In other words, highly liquid money. Now, banks should have some highly liquid money because people will come in for their money. People will come in with checks drafted on other people's accounts in the demand deposits. So, in other words, banks need to have some liquidity. And so Treasury bills and money provide that Tier 1 capital. However, that brings us to the next thing about liquidity. The problem with liquidity is that it's great because you can immediately get something else, but it also comes at the price that you don't get any investment return for it. If you had $50,000 and you put it in your pocket, well, that's great. You have extremely high liquidity, but you're not earning a dime off that money. In other words, liquidity in a company with respect to an individual, with respect to a bank, is good on one hand, but it's not good on the other. That's why when we come a little later, when I teach you how to do ratio analysis, looking at financials of companies, one of the things we'll look at is these liquidity ratios. How much cash does the company have on hand? We want the company to have some cash on hand, depending on what kind of company it is. But when a company has too much cash on hand, we say, you're wasting that money. Why aren't you building a factory? Why aren't you investing in some kind of new technology? So in other words, liquidity has a dark side to it. Great that you can buy your burger. Bad if you have so much liquidity that you can buy burgers all day long, but you're not earning anything on your investments. Okay. And of course, cryptocurrencies are in their own world extremely liquid, just instantaneous liquid. I mean, any more fiat on the electronic world. It's just really fast and highly liquid too. It's just insane how quickly you can buy one thing with another on the internet, for example. But you also have to watch out, because that's not really as liquid as it sounds, because when you buy on the internet, are you really getting it instantly? No, you're not. It still takes either a debit card or cash in your hand to get something immediately. When you talk about buying on the internet, fiat money is really liquid. No, because you're still going to have to wait for it to get to you, or you're going to have to drive to the restaurant where you ordered it online. So it's a trade-off. Okay, now, taking that into account, we can come to the role of a central bank. You see, because historically, and this has been true, central banks, the ancestors of central banks, the precursors of central banks, started showing up in Europe in the 16 and 1700s. Banks that sort of spoke for the government and for the wealthy. They were there. And in places like Italy, the Medicis, essentially, they were a banking structure that served as almost a central bank for the kings and queens and the petty tyrants around that area of the Mediterranean. And there were similar families that had banking facilities. And there was also a way by which, even in the Middle Ages, banks were coordinating with each other. These banks that would eventually become central banks were coordinating with each other, so that when these fairs happened, these merchant fairs would happen in Europe and in England, merchants could trade paper for goods, and then that paper was honored by banks, certain banks that coordinated with banks in the merchant's home country. So you had all these pieces coming together quite early on. And these fairs were a major, major way by which liquidity, transactability, and even securities were coming about in the Middle Ages. You've heard the famous song about Scarborough Fair, sung by Simon and Garfunkel. That was a real place. That was a merchant's fair. And these were popping up all over Europe, France, Germany, Spain, Italy. So we see central banks beginning to try to form. And then they got real serious in the 1800s, 1700s, in the 1800s. We were late on the scene. In our country, the banking system, the banks, it wasn't a system, it was a fiasco. It was after the Civil War, it was free market heaven. Every dog beater, cat strangler, cheater, nose picker, and child beater was a banker. You had sod banks popping up all over the place that had no capital whatsoever. They printed their own money, these banks did, which died very quickly, that money did, when the sod bank went under. And then in the big cities, you had all of these banks that were poorly capitalized. You see, if you put money into a bank, you can't keep all of it. You got to lend some of it out to make money, but you'll have to keep enough so that people can get money back if they need it. Well, a lot of these banks just simply blew all their money, and then when people went back in to get their money, it was gone, and the banks just like that, dead. By the time we get to the 1880s and 1890s, it was just insane. You had banks, it was like, you would have a bank. It was actually a legitimate bank. You were an honest banker. You kept about 20% of your deposits on reserve, okay? But this lying, cheating mofo, he had a bank that was so thinly capitalized that you'd put your money in there. You'd put your money in there. And you, what did you do? You went out and you had wine, women, and song. And you really didn't like music that much, okay? So when you guys went back in to get your money, oh my God, he doesn't have his money. And they started screaming, and all the people who were depositing in your bank said, oh my God, the bank, his bank, and you know him, you sit next to him in that finance class. So they'd come and get their money from you. You would have had enough, except that everyone hit you at the same time. And that caused your legitimate bank to go belly up because too many people had come at once and you had only 20% of their money. So you were a legit bank, but you went under. And all these other legit banks would just collapse like dominoes in these bank runs. And then people would lose all their money in the legitimate banks. And this was going on like all over the place, this kind of stuff. And sometimes, very bad people were doing another trick. These very powerful, wealthy families who wanted to consolidate and monopolize the banking system, what they would do is they wouldn't need a bad bank. What they would do is start a dirty rumor among a bunch of people about a good bank that they wanted. Did you hear that her bank is in trouble? Oh, did you hear her bank is in trouble? Did you hear that her bank is in trouble? Did you hear? And they'd all run your bank. Your bank was legit, but you couldn't handle that flux in. And your bank would collapse, self-fulfilling prophecy, and then I'd walk in. So you screwed up, didn't you? My name is Professor Rothschild, and I'll buy your bank for one penny on the dollar. You think I'm joking? That's exactly what they did. That's how they became these giant fortune, important fortune people that they did, was through that kind of dirty action. It got so bad. So many banks were failing. Now, madam, I'm going to tell you something. You are not important. Neither am I. Neither are any of the guys in your row. You are even less important. No, but the point is that we are not important. If we get screwed in a banking fiasco, no one's going to care. They're going to take a rat. They're going to turn it upside down. See this rat's ass? That's how much I care. You see, the understanding is that the common people can just get screwed all day long. But the problem was that these bank runs sometimes clipped off someone who was important. You know, the wayward child of a powerful mogul. You had a lot of money and you got burned. You lost all of it. And you get pissed off. Some very powerful person's grandma loses all of her money. And so then it became noticed by the powers that be in Washington. Oh, we've got a problem because important people, meaningful people, are getting hurt by these bank runs. And also you begin to see that I'm sure in your economics class they told you about microeconomics. And what hurts one or even a bunch of little competitive firms has no impact on a market because the firms are atomistic. But what can happen is when enough damage is done at the level of the meaningless, it becomes meaningful. In other words, you can have microeconomic impact if it's widespread enough. It begins to have macroeconomic impact. And so we had bank runs that were beginning to throw the whole American economy into recessions, one after the other, boom, boom, boom. And that began to piss off Washington, D.C. The strangest thing was that in the late 1800s, there was enough nonsense with monopolies that we had the best government money could buy in the 1800s. But even with that, the monopolies were beginning to piss off the government so much that it passed the first antitrust legislation, the Sherman Antitrust Act. And then by the time you get to the second decade of the 20th century, things got really interesting because we had this, despite the fact that the entire era was still the era of the big bosses, the monopolizers, the abuse of labor movements, the dirty treatment of child laborers, the ungodly treatment of women, you had a window in the late second decade of the 20th century of reform. It was a strange little time because it collapsed and we went back to a horrible time in the 1920s. But there was this reform. We saw the first antitrust laws. We saw antitrust laws really tighten up. and start to crack down in meaningful ways. We saw the first regulatory agencies overseeing antitrust law. We saw other kinds of legislation. And one thing we saw in that era was the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 established the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913 established the Federal Reserve, a central bank that would oversee banking. Now, by this time, you see, it's not enough. Our government was maturing and understanding things like the fact that you can't just pass a law and expect everyone to obey it. And you can't pass a law and expect some federal police to enforce it. Federal prosecutors don't have time like that. So there was beginning to get to be this understanding, starting in the 1800s with the Interstate Commerce Act, that if you're going to pass major legislation and you're going to expect the targets of it to abide by it, you're going to have to put into that legislation some kind of law that makes an agency that oversees the enforcement of it. So we had, in this era, Food and Drug Act. You can't just say, food's going to be pure, make it pure. You have to have an agency that makes sure that the companies abide by it. You had the Securities Act of 1933. You can't just say, you're going to stop cheating people when you're selling stock. You're going to have an agency that cracks down and oversees it, because the federal police, or whatever that would mean, aren't going to do that. So the Federal Reserve Act, the first thing it did was it established the Federal Reserve Bank so that there would be an agency that would oversee banks. Now, what it did, it divided the country into 12 districts. Now, the problem is now that back then the country's allocation of population was a lot different. There weren't many people out west. The East Coast was just crawling with people. So the districts on the East Coast are a lot tighter, smaller than the districts on the West Coast. So now you've got the San Francisco District Bank just pulling its hair out because it's got this vast region of high activity. But 12 districts. Now, the Federal Reserve is overseen by a board of governors. Seven governors. They are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. They're appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. One of these is the chairman. So watch it if I try to trick you. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve has seven governors and one chairman. No. It has seven governors, which includes a chairman. Now, historically, these chairmen have been all over the board. They have been extraordinarily competent, incompetent, mean-spirited, idiots. Interestingly enough now, and this is something that I'm still trying to find out what in the world is going on. The chairman of the Federal Reserve now, does anyone know who the chair is right now? It's a woman named Janet Yellen. She replaced Ben Bernanke. Now, oddly enough, I keep seeing this reference calling Yellen the co-chairman. Now, that's not how the Federal Reserve Act worked, but they keep referring to someone else who is her co. And I don't understand how that's supposed to work, who it is. But, okay, these governors, these seven governors are the cream of the crop. They are consummate professionals, at least historically. In the past 15 years, well, I shouldn't say that. Yeah, about in the past 15 years, you've gotten some in here who are really questionable. Historically, these have been high degree professionals. Unfortunately, historically, there was a lack of diversity in the Federal Reserve. In other words, I never have seen in my early years a woman, a man of color, or a woman of color. You would never have seen a Hispanic. However, it is now a much more diverse crew than it was in the past. These are the top of the top. Now, each of the 12 districts has a bank president. These are truly the cream of the crop of finance and economics and accounting. I mean, these people, I've met two of these district bank presidents in my life. You could just see they knew way more. I mean, they were just perfect human beings. I don't think they even had sex. They were just like that. I mean, you just wanted to stay kind of back from them so that, you know, in case they didn't like you, they wouldn't throttle you with their will or something like that. But now, understand that the governors regulate and the district banks supervise. The Board of Governors regulates and the district banks supervise. In other words, the Board of Governors creates the regulations interpreting law. They regulate. And then the district bank presidents oversee the banks in their district and enforce those regulations. So the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. decides, okay, this law means this, as far as practical regulation of banks goes. And then they promulgate those down to the district banks, and the district banks say, oh, we are supposed to do this when we audit the bank. We are supposed to look for this and all that. And that is essentially a two-part system which works, because then the district banks go out there and they watch their banks. But here's this funny thing about it. Here's the hilarious part of it. Federal Reserve was meant to watch over the banks. Well, the problem was that as time went on, even at the time of the Federal Reserve, the types of banks were multiplying, and the Fed didn't have regulatory authority over all of them. And now, as time went on, it had even fewer banks. It still had a vast number of banks called member banks. But there were still a vast number of banks and other financial institutions that were not under the regulatory control of the Fed. They were under some other kind of regulatory control. Like, for example, state chartered banks are watched over by state regulators. Some banks are watched over, the Fed is not allowed to bother them. They are watched over by the FDIC. Other banks are watched over by other regulatory agencies. And then you have the credit unions, which have their own regulators. It is a morass. And when, after the crisis of 2008, the dust settled, they started bringing in the Federal Reserve and all these other banking intelligentsia, and they said, all right, what's going on here? And they found out, these clueless legislators found out that there was no central regulator of banks. You did not have one authority that said, you all do this, and you all don't do this. And so there was this immediate, well, we've got to put all the banks under the Federal Reserve. Oh, yeah, that worked real well. Turf war. The states, oh, you can't do that. States' rights. And then the FDIC said, we ain't doing it. And then you had all these other regulatory agencies overseeing their types of banks saying, nope, not going to do it. They made sure that they gave enough money to those legislators that any plan to centralize the regulation of the banking industry died a very quick and very ignoble death. And so right now today, we are right back where we were when the banking crisis was building in the early 2000, in the first years of the 21st century. We have no central regulator of banks. And banks have become so powerful that essentially some of the nastiest, most criminal people in the banking industry can testify before Congress, and literally the senators and representatives cower before them. There are YouTube videos showing this humiliating show of this nasty human scumbag who runs one of the largest, most powerful banks in the world. The Federal Reserve has poured over $15 trillion into his bank and the other nine largest banks to keep them afloat because they are such crippled children. And all those senators and representatives could do is praise and just grovel at these people's feet. There were only two senators who stood up to them. I won't mention their names, but you can find it on YouTube. One of them is a woman, and she grilled him up and down. She just crucified him. And all he did was just smile because he knew she couldn't do a damn thing to him. Okay. Now, the thing is that the Federal Reserve has three separate duties. Now, you got to separate, understand, though I'm going to use the word three for something else here in a little bit. Don't get these two threes confused. The Fed, in its original charter, was ordered to do three things. Now, by the way, that little cartoony video that I'm going to have you watch, it goes through this. It probably does it better than I do. The three things that it does, but I do want to bring up something important. The three duties of the Fed. The first of them is that it regulates and supervises the banking system. And more specifically, it regulates and supervises member banks. Remember that the Board of Governors does the regulation, and then the district banks do the supervision. Now, this is one that I love to do on a pop quiz or on that online quiz. Either one, this is a classic. And don't get me wrong. There are a lot of different regulators of banks. Now, the Comptroller of the Currency is a bank regulator, too. It has its own banks, and they have hired some of my former students, and I mean those students, love their work. And these regulators, the woman who is one of the bigwigs in the Comptroller of the Currency for this area, she's spoken to my finance students before, and she explains, look, we go out in teams, we go in, we audit these banks. And we tell them, well, you're doing this right, you're doing this wrong, or we've got a problem with you with this kind of thing you're doing. And essentially, it's a great life. I mean, you travel in a limited area. She's out of the Peoria office, and I think she's hired two of my people out of that office, for that office. But they're home every weekend. A lot of Fridays they're home. They get government benefits, and they get to rise through the ranks of the government. And an interesting thing is that these regulators don't have to worry about the budget cuts. It's hilarious because there's been an effort the last few weeks. All this, oh, God, we can finally kill off these bank regulators. They'll go away because we'll just cut their funds to zero. No, you can't do that. You see, because these regulators pay for themselves. They charge the banks a fee for the regulation and the supervision and the audits, and then so they don't eat from the trough of the regular federal government. So that won't work. Okay, now, the next thing that the Fed was charged with doing, and this is actually, it sounds really boring, but it's actually really, really informative. The Fed serves as a bank for banks. A bank for banks. Now, when a bank needs a checking account, it can't use its own bank. It has to go to another bank to do it. These are called commercial banks that actually provide service, banking services for banks, you know, for the bank's deposits and loans and all that kind of stuff. So the Fed serves as a bank for banks, but there are many private commercial banks that do the same thing. And the Fed directly competes against these private commercial banks for the business of banks. You own a bank, you can go to me, the Fed, or you can go to this commercial banker and get your banking services. Now, the Fed is required by law to not do predatory pricing. In other words, the Fed can't just cut its prices down and destroy the commercial banks. Also, the Fed is required to aggressively pursue new technologies, and whenever it comes up with something new for banking, it has to share it for free with its private competitors. That's why we had the checks with the magnetic little numbers at the bottom. That was a Fed invention, and then it had to share it with all the other banks in the world. It had to. That was the way it does. Now, the Fed makes a fortune in its commercial banking operations, and it gives every penny of that back to the Treasury. It literally writes a check every year and gives it to the United States Treasury, and these checks are in the many billions of dollars. Well, I was curious. I thought, well, I didn't know. Someone asked me, well, how many banks actually use the Fed versus use a private bank? And I actually didn't know the answer to that. So I called a friend of mine at the St. Louis Fed, and I got a couple other things I'll tell you I got from them. They're very helpful down at St. Louis Fed. I said, okay, how many banks use your bank versus how many banks in your district use a private commercial bank? And he had the number very quickly. He said, well, 65%, about approximately 65% of the banks in our district use our services. 35% use the services of commercial banks, of private commercial banks. And that ratio, I said, how stable is that ratio? He said, it's been that way for decades. Essentially, we have a model here of the federal government, an agency of the federal government, providing a private commercial service in direct parallel competition with private providers, and it doesn't destroy the private providers. Those commercial banks make a fortune. The reason the Fed gets more is simply because it's a bigger player. It can handle more than the commercial banks can. But think about that for a minute when you're thinking about, okay, here's a model of a federal agency that makes money, it's profitable, but it doesn't hurt the private sector that it competes against, and in fact, it is required by law to provide any technological innovations it does with the private banking sector, and everyone in this business is flourishing. The Fed's bank for banks is flourishing, and the commercial banks, private commercial banks are flourishing. That is an amazing thing, and I communicated with a couple of legislators in Washington back in 2009. Do you understand? This is a classic model for a healthcare system. Provide it, the government can provide it, commercial can provide it, the federal has to provide any technological innovations, anything it does with the commercial banks, and it cannot do predatory pricing. It works for banking, but no one wanted to hear this idea of mine, so they can kiss my ass. The last thing that the Fed is required, is charged with doing, is conduct monetary policy. In other words, the Fed controls the money supply. Now, the Fed was originally tasked to one and only one job: maintain the stability of the aggregate price level. Put that in simple terms. The Fed is to make sure that the money supply grows in such a way that it does not create inflations or deflations. That's all. In other words, the money supply must grow at the real growth rate of the economy. In other words, you don't create more money than the economy can use as it grows, but you don't create less money than the economy can use as it grows. Because if you create more money than the economy needs as it grows, you create inflation. And the worst part of inflation is the expected inflation that comes afterwards. But if you don't produce enough money, then the economy grinds to a halt. You have a deflation. And we want to stay light years away from either of those, especially a deflation. So the Fed was essentially, they took the politics out of monetary policy. If they had done that for fiscal policy with taxes and put that in the hands of an independent organization, we would not have had the last your generation of the infighting and destructiveness we've had. But fortunately, they foresaw long ago, monetary policy could be a game that the government plays. Oh, we want to be popular and get reelected, we'll just print a pile of money right before elections. And then, of course, that'll eventually cause inflations. But you see, by putting it out of the hands of the legislators and putting it in the hands of an independent agency, you take the politics out of it. Well, of course, you've got these right-wing conspiracy theorists and some anarchists who scream bloody murder because the Constitution actually specifically says that the coinage of money would be the responsibility of Congress. And so the Federal Reserve Act essentially, by their reckoning, exactly violates something that is right in the Constitution by putting the control of the coining of money outside of Congress's purview. It's gone to the Supreme Court a couple of times. The Supreme Court says, meh, we're not going to even try to, yeah, sure, we'll close down the Fed. That's really going to work. The Fed would probably buy out the Supreme Court building and demolish it. But, that having been said, anyway, it was a depoliticization of the Fed. Unfortunately, in the 1970s, an act of Congress was passed that repoliticized the Fed. What it did was it said the Federal Reserve had now a second role in conducting monetary policy. The Fed had to help the economy. In other words, by law, the Fed was required by this new legislation, Act of Congress, to print money if the economy was sicky-poo. And of course, it would be left to another generation to claw that excess liquidity overhang back with a recession. You see, the legislature said, oh, we can't, look at all that money they're holding. Well, we're going to order them to print more of it to help the economy when it doesn't feel good. Well, the Fed was already doing this, and it was bad news that it was doing this. By the time when we got into the 1960s, we had a, for lack of a better term, and this is a political theory term. It's not a politics term. We had an era of neoliberalism come about with Jack Kennedy. This belief that the government should have and could have an active role in growing an economy. The private industry on its own was never going to build a modern world, and especially was going to be inadequate for fighting the looming menace of communism that was darkening the shore, darkening the lands of Europe. So the government was going to get involved. And it was also going to have a role in another war. The Cold War wasn't going to be the only war that we fought in the 1960s. While we were fighting in Vietnam, we were the war against communist aggression in Southeast Asia. We were going to fight a war at home. It was going to be called the War on Poverty. And we were going to fight two wars at the same time. Well, you guys have lived in the era when you guys know what happens when you try to fight two wars at one time, Afghanistan and Iraq all at once, and neither of them really goes all that well. Well, we fought Vietnam and we fought the war at home on poverty. And in order to do that, we had pretty strong taxes. No one really bitched about the taxes, but we had tax rates of the wealthiest people, 90% on their last dollar they earned. But I mean, then that still wasn't enough. And so the Fed was printing money pretty fast. And it was printing money. And then after Johnson's administration, Johnson was really aggressive with the war in Nam. And also he wanted to achieve Jack Kennedy's legacy of winning a war on poverty. So he spent a lot of money there too. Nixon came in, and notwithstanding what you might have heard about what a horrible man Nixon was, he really did continue the neoliberal policies, engagement of China, fighting the war in Vietnam, social programs at home. It was all still going on. And the Fed was printing money. By the time we get to the mid-1970s, after Richard Nixon had resigned from office, his vice president, Gerald R. Ford, took over, that money was coming back to haunt us. We were getting inflation. And inflation was making the economy feel sick. And so how do you make the economy feel better again? You print more money. If you are feeling pretty bad from that load of blow you did, I'll fix you. I'll give you a better load of blow. Uh-huh, yes, I will. And when you start bitching because you still feel bad, well, I'm just going to put you in a room and I'm just going to say, turn it on, Harley. We'll just fill you up. And that was what was happening. By the time you get to the mid-1970s, I mean, we were in, our inflation rate was going up. So what we would do is we would just print even more money faster to overcome the inflation that was eroding the purchasing power of the money that was already out there. By the time you got to, Gerald R. Ford tried to say, we're going to whip inflation now. Win. But he didn't. The Fed chairman at the time was just printing money. And so when Jimmy Carter came into office in 1976, he saw it as a religious war. He called it the moral equivalent of war. Meow, unfortunately. And no one believed him, but he was a nuclear engineer, so he finally cracked down on it. He appointed this son of a bitch to the Fed named Paul Volcker. And Volcker solved it. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it's always a bad idea to try to fix an economy with money. Now, in the short run, it feels great. I mean, if you had been my kid and I saw you sick, well, I would have given you some of my Jack. Yeah, of course. And when you came out of that, I'd give you some more to take care of the hangover. Kids get bitchy when their heads just feel like they're going to explode, you know? Right? Okay, no. I'm trying to make a very important point here. Using money to fix the problem of the economy was what the first legislation tried to stop, because you can't do it that way. You can do it through manipulation of taxes, through social programs that you move in and out as the economy does better or worse. All that's great, but when you try to play with money, money is the thing that will come back like a ghost, because once the inflation is there, then the worst thing shows up. Expected inflation. So even if you find the Lord and you bring down your money supply, you're going to have a hard time convincing people that you've done that, convincing banks that you've done that, convincing everybody. You can't fix it the way that the government wants us to. But anyway, here's where we stand right now with these duties of the Fed, regulates, supervises the member banks, and all of that kind of stuff. And from there, monetary policy can be done, three tools of monetary policy. If I put $100 into the bank, and the bank keeps 10% of it as a reserve, and 90% it can lend, the bank will keep $10 and lend out $90. And the bank will keep $9 in the vault for people who need their money and then lend out $81. And it'll keep $8.10 of that in the bank and lend out the rest. And I can't even think of what that is. This is how you can make a money supply grow. The Fed sets the required reserve ratio. Look at this. by the end of the day, $100 has turned into $1,000. How do I know that? Because the change in the money supply will be the original amount of money times 1 over the required reserve ratio. So if the Fed jacks the ratio up to 20%, that slows down the growth. If the Fed drops the rate to 5%, that accelerates the growth. This is a blunt, blunt tool. The Fed would be very unlikely to use this tool very often. The second one is that the Fed lends money to banks. It's called discount. It's called the discount window. The Fed sets a rate for the discount window. Historically, banks didn't borrow from the Fed. They didn't want the aggravation of having the Fed ask them questions, so they borrowed from each other. But the Fed, so we've got the required reserve ratio. The second one is the discount rate. Now, interestingly enough, most banks chose, instead of using the discount window, to borrow from other banks. So the discount rate was almost like sort of just a showpiece. The real action was the Federal Reserve, what's called the Fed funds rate, which is not set by the Fed. It can manipulate it by the third method. The third method is the open market operations. The Fed buys treasury bills from the U.S. Treasury. It lends money to the Treasury. And then what it can do, it's pretty simple in theory. You're a bank. I want to get money away from you so you don't have as much money. I can just call you up and sell you treasury bills at cheap prices. Okay? If I want you to have more money, I can offer to buy the treasury bills you have in your Tier 1 capital at ridiculously high prices. That way you get more money. So I can make the money supply change. That's the way the Fed does it every day, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. Now, that's all I have for you today. I'm going to hold off on that special topics quiz and postpone it until after the lecture on Monday, so you don't have to worry about that over the weekend. That's all I have for you. I thank you.